Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday, the 25th of October, these are our main stories. Indonesian investigators have blamed design flaws in the Boeing 737 MAX plane and human error for last year's Lion Air disaster. Iraqi security forces have fired live rounds and tear gas at protesters marching in Baghdad. And the Solomon Islands has scrapped a plan to lease an entire island to a Chinese company. Also in this podcast,
enjoy the rock and walk around, not sit on it, step on it, you're hurting the rock.
How Australia's Indigenous people managed to get a national landmark shut off from hikers. Now, to the latest findings from the investigation into the Lion Air aeroplane malfunction, which saw the craft crash into the sea off Jakarta a year ago, killing everyone on board. A litany of design, engineering and human errors are being blamed by investigators in Indonesia. 189 people died on the Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft. The same type of plane crashed earlier this year in Ethiopia. All MAX 8 planes have since been grounded. I've been speaking to our transport correspondent, Theo Leggett, who told me more about the report's findings.
It's a very comprehensive report. It's about 350 pages long, and it describes an absolute catalogue of failures, any one of which, if they hadn't happened, might have prevented the accident. There's an awful lot of what-ifs here. But fundamentally, it shows that the failure of a single sensor, which was faulty, which arguably may not have been tested when it was fitted to the aircraft, led to a flight control system known as MCAS, which Boeing had fitted aboard the aircraft, malfunctioning and basically working against the pilots, so forcing the nose of the aircraft down when the pilots were trying to gain height. Despite this, the captain of the aircraft did manage to keep flying it for several minutes, but there was poor communication, the report says, between him and his first officer. The report also suggests that the first officer's flying skills weren't what they should have been, and when he took over control of the aircraft from the captain, perhaps so that the captain could try and figure out what was actually going on, he was unable to fly the plane and it crashed into the Java Sea, killing 189 people. So it spreads blame if it could. The idea of this report is not to give blame, it's to say what happened, but you know, it spreads responsibility around a number of people from the part manufacturer through to the airline, through to Boeing and regulators. But fundamentally, it doesn't change the fact that what happened here was Boeing fitted a system to its aircraft, which was vulnerable to a single point of failure, and regulators signed off on that. So it doesn't lift the pressure from Boeing and the regulators, even though Lion Air clearly has questions to answer as well.
Indeed. Briefly, Theo, what's been the reaction from Boeing? They say they want the 737 MAX 8 aircraft to be flying before the end of the year. How likely is that now?
It probably won't be flying again before next year, in all honesty. Boeing has produced new software to rectify all the problems with the system. They're confident it will be safe once it flies again. It now needs to do certification flights with regulators, not just from the United States, but also from Europe. That's going to happen in December. And that means it's most likely that the plane will be flying again early next year. And then, of course, customers have to be persuaded that this aircraft is fundamentally safe and that they can fly on it once again.
Theo Leggett. Meanwhile, in Iraq. That's the security forces firing live rounds and tear gas at protesters in the centre of Baghdad. There, at least one person has died as a result. It's the latest in a series of protests over economic hardship and corruption allegations that have left more than 150 people dead since the beginning of the month. There have been calls for the government to resign, but in a televised address, Prime Minister Adil Abdul Mahdi said it would send the country into chaos. Our correspondent Ali Mukbul is in Iraq and told me more.
The first thing to say is that they are still going on. They started in the early hours of the morning. Thousands of people, mainly young men, a lot of them, from the sounds of things, unemployed, having issues with the way in which the government's run, but with their own economics, marched through Baghdad, across a bridge, and towards the Green Zone. And that's when first tear gas was fired, but then also live rounds as well by the police. And as you rightly said in your introduction, this follows protests early this month, which were the worst violence in Iraq since the declaration that the Islamic State group had been defeated 2 years ago. And in those protests, at least 150 people were killed.
And briefly, Alim, tell us what kind of economic hardship ordinary Iraqis are suffering from at the moment.
Well, we're talking about an astronomical unemployment rate, but a lot of the frustration is borne out not just of the economics at the moment, but also a lack of provision of services like electricity, the frustration about corruption in government, but also with the system itself here in Iraq, where there is very much sectarian politics at play, where there are quotas for certain groups to be in power, and frustration that the leaders appointed by politicians are appointed on the basis of favours that those politicians will get back and not in terms of how qualified someone is for the role. So it's a combination of all of those things that's led to people taking to the streets.
And the Prime Minister on Wednesday said that we're going to make reforms, reduce the salaries of top officials, provide more income for poor families. That, from what you're saying, sounds unlikely to be enough.
No, he's also talking about prosecuting the police and military leaders who were responsible, as he sees it, for the death of all those people. Yes, that the problem is not just this government for a lot of people. It is the system under which they're living.
Ali Makbul. British police have arrested two suspected people traffickers after 39 migrants were found dead in a refrigerated lorry east of London on Wednesday. Tracking data shows the trailer crossed the channel several times in the past 10 days, moving between France, Belgium and Britain, Ireland and Northern Ireland. Daniel Sanford has this brief update on the arrest so far.
The 38-year-old man and 38-year-old woman are being held on suspicion of 39 counts of manslaughter, as well as conspiracy to traffic people. A 25-year-old man from Northern Ireland arrested on Wednesday morning is also still in custody. Detectives say post-mortem examinations of the first victims will begin today.
Daniel Sanford. Now let's head down under, where one of the country's most important landmarks and tourist spots has just closed for climbers. The famous rock is called Uluru, and for years people have been scaling it. But Australia's Indigenous people have for years asked people not to, because the ancient sandstone monolith is sacred ground with spiritual significance to them. Phil Mercer went to the rock as locals and tourists queued up to take their last chance to climb it.
It's about 5:30 in the morning. It's quite breezy. It's about 20 degrees Celsius. And this is a transition period when night slowly turns into day. And looking up at the giant mass of red rock, you can see it silhouetted against the emerging daylight. And it has a real power about it.
It's going to get to 40 degrees. That wind's going to start blowing up there. You will dehydrate very, very quickly. You need to have plenty of water with you, OK?
It's a rock. It's there. It's a rock. It's supposed to be climbed.
I know it is closing down, so I want to be the last one to be up there. Just want to have a look.
Something we've wanted to do for years, and it would be unfortunate if we didn't do it.
This is pretty extraordinary, and the queues are stretching right around the corner from the car park. We've just seen dozens and dozens of people pour off three or four buses, and they have joined a queue of several hundred people who are taking the opportunity to climb Uluru for the very last time.
My view is that Australia should be for all Australians, so I've got no problem at all in people climbing the rock.
I'm in two minds. I actually climbed it when I was like 27, but I also respect the Aboriginal rights, to be perfectly honest.
Aboriginal Australians consider the earth to be the mother of creation. It's full of secrets and wisdom, and that's why Indigenous people here have always asked visitors not to climb Uluru, not to scale this massive red rock, because they believe it's deeply sacrilegious.
My number
To raise a nipper is an Aboriginal elder. She says the rock is special and that sitting or walking on it causes it pain.
So we respect Ngoranyangaja. That's why I climb Patino. Tourists enjoy the rock and walk around, not sit on it. Step on it. You're hurting the rock. It's so special to us.
What we know has been a bit of a spike with the numbers of visitors coming to Uluru, and then that spike will drop a bit, but we don't think numbers will significantly drop after the closure. Mike Misso, manager of Uluru Kadajudu National Park. Look, it's like a lot of places around the world. It's a bit of a, maybe they see it as a sense of achievement and it's, wow, let's climb Uluru on the bucket list. But over many years, numbers of people wanting to climb has actually declined. And before the climb closure was announced, it was less than 10% who actually climbed Uluru.
We climbed yesterday, only because it's been our dream to do it. Our parents both did it on the same day and they didn't know each other. So it's just one of the things we really wanted to tick off our bucket list. My boyfriend did propose, so I think it was a pretty good experience.
Treasured memories for some, but closing the climb will bring to an end years of distress for Aboriginal groups. As one elder said, it's time the rock had a rest.
Phil Mercer. Now, you may not have heard of the word voluntourism, but it's a term describing young people, usually from Western countries, volunteering in developing nations. The Harry Potter author, J.K. Rowling, is calling on people to stop volunteering in overseas orphanages. She says the practice is actually driving family separation and even child trafficking. Charlotte Gallagher reports.
You may have seen photos on social media of young, usually well-meaning but unqualified people surrounded by children they think they're helping. Many volunteer in orphanages in less wealthy nations as part of their travelling experience. But J.K. Rowling says many of these children aren't actually orphans but have ended up in institutions because of poverty and even trafficking. Some have been lured there to attract volunteers. Rowling's charity Lumos says around 80% of the 8 million children in orphanages around the world have at least one living parent. Chloe Setter from the charity says volunteers need to realise the harm they could be doing.
The high turnover of having these unskilled regular volunteers causes attachment issues in children. And what one of the particular issues that most people are really not aware of is that orphanages have become a big business. And we actually see, in some cases, children are trafficked to orphanages to cater for this demand from volunteers and tourists.
Lumos says the huge amount of international funding these orphanages receive could be used to keep families together. The Ugandan-based campaign group No White Saviours says it's far too common to see children growing up in orphanages or placed for international adoption when they have biological families. It adds that many people don't want to invest in keeping families together because they're making money from orphanages. Last year, Australia became the first country to recognise orphanage trafficking as a form of modern-day slavery. The then foreign minister said children had been turned into tourist attractions.
Charlotte Gallagher. Now, every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World This Week. And Caroline Wyatt joins me now to tell me what's in the latest edition.
The boss of Google called it a Hello World moment. Others have compared it to the Wright brothers' pioneering powered flight. We look at whether Google really has achieved quantum supremacy with its new computer. Also, big protests are shaking the system in Lebanon and Chile. What lies behind the King of Thailand sacking his official concubine? And the clash of values at the heart of the row between China and American basketball.
Thanks, and that's all in The World This Week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website, www.bbc.co.uk/programmes. Still to come in this podcast...
They are effectively a Land Rover with two great big knives on the front.
More tales from the forefront of climate change, this time with African rhinos. When the Solomon Islands ended diplomatic relations with Taiwan and transferred their links to Beijing, it was likely that there were economic reasons for the decision. The shift in allegiance sparked a strong rebuke from the United States. But now the government of the Solomon Islands has blocked a deal signed by one of its provinces to lease the entire island of Tulagi to a Chinese company, saying that that would be unlawful and should be terminated. Well, Professor Peter Grease of Manchester University's China Institute told Dan Damon why China wants Tulagi.
A lease on one of these provincial islands would give China, I think, more security militarily and potentially access to a variety of resources. Of course, the larger shift of diplomatic recognition of the entire country from Taiwan to Beijing is part of the Chinese goal of reunifying Taiwan by squeezing Taiwan's international space and trying to make reunification appear inevitable.
Well, the Solomon Islands government has put a block on this. Do you think that's because they're concerned about China or concerned about the commercial arrangements?
My guess is it's a combination of concerns about the financial dealing and the potential debt trap kind of situation that has occurred in other situations that are analogous, such as in Sri Lanka with their port there. But there may also be more nationalistic concerns about state sovereignty.
But there must surely have been something on offer when the Solomon Islands changed its diplomatic relations from Taiwan to China. I mean, there must have been some financial inducement.
Yes, and my guess was that this was part of the behind-the-scenes conversations, but it appears that the people of the Solomon Islands were not aware of something as specific and extreme as essentially leasing an entire province. So again, I think probably the people of the Solomon Islands were aware that there were economic reasons for making this shift. After all, Taiwan and China, the main way that they have competed over recognition from third countries is through offering different kinds of trade and aid as inducements. So that was clearly on the table. But the specifics, again, of essentially ceding sovereignty of an entire province, I think that probably brought in a whole new dimension to the issue, which is why I think there's been such a strong response.
Professor Peter Grease. About 40,000 people north of Los Angeles have been told to leave their homes because of a fast-moving wildfire. The latest blaze to hit California, known as the Tick Fire, broke out late on Thursday near Santa Clarita, and it swiftly escalated because of high winds and dry conditions. In Northern California, a separate fire in the Sonoma wine-producing area also prompted a mandatory evacuation order. Earlier this month, wildfires raged 4,700 acres north of Los Angeles and forced thousands to flee. At a news conference, Daryl Osby, the fire chief of Los Angeles County, gave an update on the ongoing situation.
Currently, we're estimating the fire to be at 3,950 acres plus with zero containment. And we have over 500 firefighters on the incident right now. And we had approximately 10,000 structures that were impacted by the incident.
Los Angeles County Supervisor Catherine Vargas said specialist teams were trying to control the blaze.
Last reports were approximately 40,000 to 50,000 residents had been evacuated. We know numerous homes have been burned, and we cannot get an accurate count during the evening, so bear with us. We know that at least six, but that number may rise. Focus now is continuing to stop the forward progress and getting perimeter control. With the winds picking up, we're very cognizant of the fact that this is going to be first and foremost to try to get perimeter control.
The governor of California, Gavin Newsom, told journalists that his team was doing the best it could and taking the necessary precautions to contain the fire.
These conditions are multifaceted. It's not just dry weather, it's high winds, low humidity. A consequence of these characteristics aligning as they have, we are taking precautions, not just the utilities, but the state itself.
That was the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, speaking about those wildfires in California. Now, for anyone wondering about the movements of earthworms around the world, and let's face it, who hasn't, scientists have compiled the first ever global atlas of the creature's range and locations. Helen Briggs has the details.
Efforts to catalogue flora and fauna have concentrated on life above ground, but now scientists have turned their attention to the earthworms that carry out vital roles beneath our feet. A worldwide survey found temperate zones are a hotspot for earthworms, with the soils of southern England harbouring a particularly high diversity and abundance of species. Learning more about earthworms and where they live will help give better protection to the burrowing creatures, which improve the soil and bring benefits for farmers and gardeners alike. But the researchers say their study suggests earthworms are sensitive to climate change, which might have serious implications for animals in the soil and the services they provide to nature.
Helen Briggs there. And staying with climate change and the natural world, President Trump has now confirmed that he will pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. He described the international agreement that commits 195 countries to curbing their greenhouse gas emissions as a bad deal. Toby Strong is a wildlife cameraman who's travelled the world and witnessed the effects of climate change firsthand. He's recorded various audio diaries for us, and his latest is in Kenya, with the rhinos there.
We've spent the last 2 weeks filming rhinos. From before sunrise to after sunset, we film them on foot, from the air, and from vehicles. And I've grown really attached to them. They are effectively a Land Rover with two great big knives on the front. But they're so gentle, and they move with a nimbleness you wouldn't expect. We followed them from before dawn till after sunset every day. They graze and sleep. They're delicate with each other, their interactions. It's been wonderful to be this close to something this large, but the perimeter fence I can see is a constant reminder that they need protecting. The landscape in the conservancy is dominated by Mount Kenya. It's funny, you don't often see her because she's shrouded in low cloud, but you know she's there. There's forests and rivers, but the land that dominates is the ubiquitous grasslands. They roll away to the horizon, dotted with acacia trees. But outside of the protected areas, things are changing. Over the last 20 years that I've been travelling to Kenya, I've been struck by how fast it's becoming an industrialised nation, and I've seen huge tracts of wilderness become industrial parks and agriculture on a huge scale, monocrops vanishing off into the distance. As our planet's temperature rises, Kenya is facing another year of really hard drought. The lush, fertile plains of East Africa are shrinking, and it's putting farmers and cattle herders in direct competition with the wildlife for the remaining land. So conservancies like these are becoming even more crucial in giving wildlife a chance. And it's through their hard work that there is now hope for the rhino.
Toby Strong in Kenya. It's time now for news from elsewhere. I'll look at some of the week's less reported stories from around the world. With me in the studio is Crassy Twig from the BBC monitoring team, which follows media in many different languages. And Crassy, your first story is from Iran, and it's prompted a lot of anger there, hasn't it? Tell us about it.
This is about an Iranian Instagram star who has become famous around the world because of her numerous plastic surgeries that made her look a lot like American star Angelina Jolie. She's called Saha Tabar, she's 22, and she made global headlines again earlier this month when it was reported that she was arrested on a number of charges, including blasphemy, upsetting the Islamic dress code, encouraging corruption among young people. And what's happened now, almost a month later, is that she's been paraded on Iranian TV with her face blurred. She was introduced as a zombie and an example of how the madness to become famous on social media has ruined a real life. One thing she says is, my mother was trying to tell me to stop and I didn't listen, which gives the impression that she regrets altering her looks.
So what's been the reaction to this on social media?
Well, this has widely been seen by Persian speakers as a dirty confession, and many people are calling for such shameful broadcasts, as they call them, to end. There's also a lot of sympathy for her. Some call her just a sick girl. Someone pointed out that having tattoos and making videos seems to be a bigger crime in Iran than things like embezzlement and murder. One takeaway from this interview is that Tabar rejects the Western media perception that she wanted to look like Angelina Jolie. She says she based her look on the main character in the animated musical dark fantasy Corpse Bride. And finally, one thing to point out is that the look she presents on Instagram are not just the result of plastic surgery. There's a lot of makeup and a lot of artistry and image editing. So a lot of creativity has gone into them.
And talking about creativity, inmates in Russia seem to have come up with a very novel way of getting drugs delivered to them by enlisting the help of a cat.
Yes, a drug smuggling cat has been caught in the Republic of Tatarstan. It tried to gain entry into a penal colony carrying a brown substance thought to be hash in its collar. Somebody filmed the whole chase for our entertainment, so it's all out there. And by the way, this is not the first time a cat's been caught red-pawed in Russia. There's now a famous case of a cat that was apparently used as a drug mule in 2018 for another prison mate in another region south of Moscow. And the twist in the tale came last week when it was reported that the cat, which is now held in a zoo and it's meant to provide a key piece of evidence in the ongoing trial, escaped custody. So that is a problem now because the cat is critical to both the prosecution and the defense. There was going to be an experiment to see if the cat was actually able to carry that weight of drugs in its collar. So with the cat on the run, the case could collapse.
Grassi, many thanks indeed for that. So talking of getaways, my colleague Jackie Leonard has just walked into the studio. Jackie, so tell us about exactly when Britain is going to leave the European Union. That is a very, very, very unfair question. But you do have news of a particularly new enticing podcast, which is going to tell us all about things Brexity.
All the things that it is knowable to know. I have been promising this for quite some time. Podcast listeners will know I've kept saying at some point before the end of the month. The thing is, we kept having dates to do it. We were going to do it on Monday, and then we were going to do it on Saturday, and then we were going to do it yesterday. And things have kept getting in the way.
Events, dear boy.
So eventually we just thought, okay, let's just do it. So we managed to get the studio together and we got together with the Brexit Cast team. Brexit Cast is a podcast in which our splendid colleagues, Katia Adler, Adam Fleming, Chris Mason and Laura Koonsberg, who are experts in this stuff, get together and thrash it out. They have been living and breathing this stuff for 3.5 years. Everything it is possible to know about Brexit, they know.
This is complex for politicians and it's complex for those who voted. And so you often just have a really big feeling in the UK of anger, frustration, dissatisfaction. And, you know, if I were a politician, I wouldn't really know how to make everybody happy either at this stage. I don't know if the three of you have an idea.
Laura?
No.
There are still quite a lot of unknown things, it must be said, but they have been answering questions from our listeners. Keep an eye out for the Global News Brexit Cast collaboration, which will be on your normal podcast feed. It will be in addition to the normal Global News Pod, so you won't miss out on any news stuff, but all things Brexit coming up.
And I can recommend everybody should be listening to that, the big Brexit brains of the BBC. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.